Legal Aid New South Wales advises that this podcast contains reference to distressing content. Examples of this content include references to drug use, childhood abuse, violence, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised. The views expressed in this podcast may not reflect the views of Legal Aid New South Wales.
Legal Aid New South Wales would like to acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. I'm your host, Cody Baxter, proud Burrabarongal Darug woman, criminal lawyer and Closing the Gap Senior Project Officer. I'm joined today by Brad, a 28-year-old Burrabarongal Darug and Kamilaroi man, who's currently on parole after serving 6 years, 9 months in custody. So thanks for joining me today, Brad.
No worries, I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So when did you get released from custody?
So the end of last year, the 25th of November, I think it was.
Wow, so pretty recently. And are you loving it?
Oh, I wouldn't say loving it, but it's good to be out.
You wouldn't say you're loving it. Are there things that you miss about jail?
No, there's definitely nothing I miss, but it's just, other than COVID and technology, nothing's really changed, so it's still kind of the same.
Yeah. What about technology has changed since you've been released from custody?
Probably the most annoying thing is Opal cards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So before you went into custody, there were no Opal cards?
Oh, no, they just come, but you didn't have to use one. You could still buy a paper ticket.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So where did you grow up, Brad?
That's a good question. Really, I moved around a lot. But I was born in Liverpool, in Liverpool Hospital in 94. So from there, I lived in Bass Hill for the start of my childhood to move to Yagoona. And then from there, too many different places, to tell you the truth. I think I went to 12 different public schools from kindergarten to year six.
Yeah, and how was that growing up?
Oh, it was a bit chaotic, always being a new kid at a different school. I think the longest I ever did at the school was from halfway through year five to graduation in year six. So pretty chaotic.
And what about high school?
That was just as bad. I did four schools in a year and a half, so I got expelled halfway through year eight when the start of that law, the end of the 14 and 9 months, you could leave school. So that year they changed it to you had to be 17 before you could legally leave school. But due to my history, I'd say, and my prominence to violence, that they give me a leeway and said that it's acceptable for you to leave because you're not fit to be in a mainstream school.
Basically, school's not for you.
No, it wasn't, no.
And when you say your history, what do you mean?
Oh, well, as a juvenile, I was very reckless and violent and just always seemed to get into fights from probably kindergarten to up to 5, 6, 7 years ago before I went to jail. So, but that's just, I don't know why it was. It wasn't really that I'd fight for the sake of fighting. It was more sticking up for other people and trying to protect people I thought couldn't protect themselves, which isn't really a smart decision, even though people think it's the right thing to do, but you always seem to get yourself into more trouble than help.
And were you really angry, or was there anything kind of contributing to that, or was it more just to try and protect those around you?
I don't know if I'd say angry, but maybe like disappointed or frustrated for the fact that I didn't have a stable childhood or a normal upbringing, as people in like society would like to call it, but for the fact that I had parents that were drug addicts and suffered from severe mental health and moved around from mother to father for my whole childhood. So that probably might have been a underlying issue, but I don't think I was angry at the world and took it out on people. No, I think it was more I'd just been a scenario and I'd use violence instead of my brain.
And were there things that you really loved about your childhood, like family members and things like that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, so I grew up with a big family. So on my dad's side, I think I couldn't tell you how many cousins and second and third cousins I've got, but a lot of my family are different in age gaps. So my dad's one of eight and he's got older brothers, sisters, younger brothers, younger sisters. So he's also got cousins that he grew up with that were more close to his age gap. So they were like brothers and sisters, and then their kids were more like first cousins to me, but they were second or third cousins. So it was a pretty big family. I got to admit, Christmases were usually always pretty good, and sometimes like get-togethers, we used to have a few different get-togethers down at the river and stuff like that. So that was always good to just be around family. Why I was kind of accepted by family, I suppose, is still at that stage before I come more of a like black sheep, if you could try to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think It's so indicative of growing up Aboriginal to have all these mix of generations where perhaps maybe people who don't have that background don't understand that we don't, you know, our cousins are like our brothers and sisters, and they might really be our uncles, but, you know, they're great uncles, and nans are just nans. There's no all that other stuff added in.
Yeah, definitely not. That's the good thing about our culture and being a proud Indigenous person, is the fact that no matter what family member it is, it could be fourth, fifth, sixth cousin, they could be as close to you as your brother or your sister or your mother or your father, just for the fact that we're all mob and we choose to love each other unconditionally and be there for if that's how close you are and that's the type of person you grew up with, no matter the age gap or the relation, as they want to call it, so second, third, like it's just mob, it's just family, and it's just good to be able to accept that. A lot of people that aren't Indigenous don't seem to understand how we are close, such close, in like with relatives that are maybe, I don't know how much percentage of a bloodline, but like a distant bloodline, and they think it's probably silly or not normal, but it's just how it is when you grow up in a big family.
All right. I want to take you back now to your first experience of custody. And do you remember being locked up overnight for the first time?
Yeah, I do.
And how old were you?
That I can't tell you the age exactly, but it was for, as far as I'm aware, it was for a bench warrant. So it was for not going to court and just previous charges that I decided I didn't want to deal with, so I went on the run, and then they eventually caught up to me, and then after getting bail so many times, they refused me bail and I spent the night in juvenile detention.
And so if you were to give it a rough guess, like, would you say 15, 16?
I think, yeah, it would have been in between 15 and 16.
Yeah. And do you remember what that felt like? Like, were you scared, or did you kind of feel, you know, that you had it under control?
I don't know if fear was so much of an issue. Like, I'm not sitting there and saying that it's easy and it's not scary, but it's more, I think, like isolation and kind of like abandonment. Like, you feel like you've got no one and you're by yourself and you can't reach out to anyone, you can't call anyone, so not knowing what the outcome's going to be, if you're going to get out, if you're not going to get out. So it's more of the isolation factor. I think that's the fear, not like the fear of, oh, what's going to happen, or am I going to be all right? It's like, oh, what's next? Where do we go?
Yeah, and then how does it feel? I always wonder this. Being the person on the AVL screen, watching your lawyer talk to you and watching this courtroom talk about you, and you're expected to sit there and not say anything.
That's probably one of the hardest things I personally believe about court, is the fact that you've got to sit there and listen to everything that's said and spoken about, and you're expected not to make comments or not to make any body movements or roll your eyes or acknowledge something that you don't agree with without getting the proceedings stopped and then told to be quiet and sit there and be seen and not heard, pretty much, and you've got no control at all of what's getting said or what the outcome's going to be. That's probably one of the most daunting things about court, I believe, or I personally feel.
Yeah, and I imagine that everyone, I mean, going into the AVL suite in custody, and for those listening, if you're not sure of what the AVL suite is, it's kind of like little booths with little TV screens in there, and everyone's doing AVLs all at the same time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. But the one thing is, they are sound, or they try to be as much soundproof as they can. Like, you can't pretty much hear, like, fluently what's going on, but, like, you can hear background noise and understand what's going on. It's more the people that are waiting to get into the booths themselves where the noise comes from and the carrying on, and because they've been sitting in the cage, some of them for 5-6 hours waiting to get their turn to go in front of an AVL screen, and by that time you're pretty hostile and you're not sitting there thinking, oh, there's people in the booth that's going to court. You're thinking, I want to get up in front of this screen, what's going on, like, get me in front of the judge. So you just carry on and make as much noise as you can towards the officers to try to get the proceedings pushed along, but they've got no control over it. It's the court at the end of the day that controls where you go up, how long you're in the room for. So, but the booth, it's kind of a little sanctuary compared to how AVL's situated in a jail, because you're in a cage with sometimes can be up to 30 other men.
Wow. And
they're all waiting to be sentenced or speak to their lawyer or who knows what they're actually there for. And then you're in a cage, it's probably maybe 5-6 metres long and maybe 3 metres wide. And there's sometimes up to 30 blokes. And it's not just one of them cages. There's 4, 5, maybe 6 of them side by side. So you've got sometimes up to 100 people there, and it's just chaotic. Like, sometimes even the officers don't know what's going on. They'll give people the wrong phones. They'll put people in the wrong AVL suites in front of the wrong judges. And it's just frantic.
Yeah, wow. It sounds a bit like a zoo in there.
It definitely is.
And do you think everyone's kind of, I mean, like going to court is so bloody stressful, even when, sometimes when I think I'm the lawyer. And do you think everyone kind of feeds off each other's emotion? Like if someone's having a bad court day, or is it kind of, sometimes can it be supportive?
Oh, it's definitely supportive. Like unless there's an issue between two inmates, like everybody supports everybody because they all know what's going to happen for the fact that they've all been there, or most of the people have been in front of a magistrate or been sentenced before, and they understand what's going on with the other inmate. So that is actually pretty supportive unless there's an underlying issue between previous inmates from a different scenario, and then it can be a bit full on and heated, can turn into violence and stuff like that. But it's a pretty harmonious kind of vibe, if I'd say, because you all know that you're there to be sentenced, or you're there to find out what's going to happen in your fate. And most of the time, everybody's happy to see someone come back and they get bail, or they get a good sentence, or they go home. And then it gives you a good feeling thinking, all right, well, that could happen to me. So it takes away a lot of the negativity too. But then also people come back and they get slapped, and then the mood changes, and then everybody's bagging the judge or bagging the lawyer and saying that's not fair. Like, how could that happen? So it all depends on the precedent, really. But it's more harmonious for the fact that you want to support your fellow inmates, for the fact that it's you against them. It's how it is in custody. Like, it's always been blue versus green. Mm. And it will always be blue versus green. And even though a judge doesn't wear blue, they're still part of that side. So you want the best outcome for the other inmates, so the judge can sit there and be like, oh, I wish I got a better result than that. Or the prosecutor, sorry, not the judge. But then we're sitting back laughing, thinking, well, you didn't do that right, did you, mate? You screwed up. So it's always good to know that someone comes back with a good result.
Yeah. I mean, we've been having some conversations off the record, and I've been really impressed with your knowledge and understanding of the legal system. And do you think that you learn all of that just from being in custody and having talks with the boys and things like that?
100%. Like, honestly, as bad as it is, like, jail is a criminal college. It's as simple as that. Like, you could go into jail not knowing anything and come out and be a master criminal. And sometimes it's the worst scenario for someone that could have a chance to get their life back on track, for the fact that they think, all right, I can still make it, I can still make it. And then they go into custody and they get all this knowledge of wealth and think, oh, well, I can do that. Or I didn't know how to do that. And then you start to do more things and you end up with more criminal record. And then with people that are on remand and that are fighting their charges and going through trial, you speak to blokes that have been sentenced or have been through similar charges, and you speak to all them different characters and you find out what they know and their knowledge, and then you store that yourself. So when you go in, you've got all this knowledge that you're already prepared, and you could think, all right, well, this could happen, this could happen, it could go this way. And it does really help. And I honestly believe that I learned a lot of... I sat on remand for, I think, nearly 2 years, 2.5 years. So I was going to court a lot of the time, and you pick up on a lot of little things and a little, like, not so much like terminology or like actual proper words for stuff, but just in general of like sentencing remarks and like what the standard period is, or how much you think someone's going to get, and what judge is like nice, what judge is an what solicitor's going to actually go into bat for you, what solicitor's just going to go, mate, plead guilty because I don't want to deal with you, because I don't think you've got a case even though you want to fight it. So It does help, that fact, to know that there is other people that have there that can support you when you go in and you don't know nothing.
And so drawing on that, if you think about your lawyers, what could your lawyers have done differently to fill that gap? Because it sounds like you got heaps of knowledge from the boys in custody. But
oh, most definitely.
Did your lawyer ever explain all these things to you, or well, could they have done that better?
When I first got arrested and I was going to court, I was going to a certain courthouse, and I had a really good solicitor, and this solicitor was probably the best solicitor I've ever had throughout all the times I've been in trouble from the age of 15. And he taught me a lot, and instead of just saying, oh, this is going to happen, this is happening, he actually took the time to explain what he was talking about and what the outcome or what something meant, so that I had a better knowledge so I could make his job easier by not hitting him with 1,000 questions going, oh, well, what's that, what's that? So every time he brought up something new or a new term, he'd explain to me what that term was and give me a better understanding. But unfortunately, after hearing, they changed my courthouse when they moved me from local to district, and I lost that solicitor. And from that point onwards, it was pretty much nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. Nobody wanted to continue the conversation and try to help and explain or and they changed, I think, maybe four solicitors or five solicitors from the time I got moved from local to district. And then I think 2 weeks out or 2 months out from my trial, I got another solicitor that knew nothing about my case, hadn't been over it, hadn't even read one page of my brief. So I don't think there's too many of them that are willing to explain to their clients what's actually going on and what certain things mean and what certain outcomes could be.
What lawyers have you had that have done things really well that you think every solicitor should think about?
I think, honestly, just want to be there. Like, no matter what your prejudice is, no matter how serious the crime is, if you're a criminal defence lawyer, you should be there to defend your client no matter what. So if that means you've got to sit there for 2 hours and speak to them and explain everything to help them to help you, well, you should do it. Other than just going, all right, well, I don't think you're going to get found innocent. I believe you're going to get found guilty. So therefore, I'm going to tell you to plead guilty because I don't want to have to put in the work to fight for this matter because I personally have prejudice and don't agree with your crime, even though it's a big no-no and no solicitor will admit that they don't like what people are in for, which it's you're a human being. Like a lot of people are going to be offended and probably like terrified and disgusted at certain people's crimes, and that's understandable. But at the end of the day, you're in a job where that's what you've got to deal with every day. So the fact that sometimes they don't really want to be there, I think, is a big issue where they really need to take the time to explain or to give the knowledge to make people understand what's going on and what the factors are and where they're going to probably end up. But a solicitor these days will spend a good hour arguing with you to get you to change your mind with something you're telling them to do that they don't want to do. It doesn't matter how bad they look in front of a judge. If you say, mate, I want you to go up there and tell him the sky's purple, they represent you. They've got to tell him the sky's purple.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel for some solicitors because I think, and I'd love to get your opinion on this too, sometimes you do get cases that do appear to be very strong, and I do think that it is a balancing act to make sure that your client does understand the strength of the prosecution case in some circumstances. So would you appreciate a lawyer sitting down and telling you why they think the case is strong, and have you ever had somebody do a good job at that?
A few times I've had some issues where there's been certain cases where it's been pretty closed and shut book, where it's I'm going to be found guilty, and I've argued for a long time that I don't plead guilty because a lot of people in the life that I used to live won't plead guilty for the fact that you're telling on yourself and you don't tell. So that's a big reason why people will not plead guilty, for the fact that it doesn't matter if you're telling on yourself, you're still telling, and that's against the criminal code, unfortunately. So I do feel for the solicitor there when it's a pretty closed shut case where they're going to get found guilty no matter how much they try, but the client doesn't want to plead guilty for the fact of own principles and moral, which I do feel for solicitors there. So, yeah, I do believe that if they took the time to sit there and explain and show, well, this is the facts, this is the evidence, this is how the trial, this is how the case is going to run, this is where it's going to end up, and this is going to be the outcome. Some inmates might go, oh, actually, now that you've sat down and explained that to me, and I understand because you've taken as much time as you've needed to show me the steps that are going to unfold, it might help. But a lot of solicitors get frustrated for the fact that they don't feel like the client's listening to them and they're not being heard and they're just being ridiculous, which therefore causes a lack in communication, and then it causes a rift, if you should say, in like aggression. And then it's like, well, they don't really want to work with each other. And then that's where I think the communication unfolds, because they both feel like they're not getting heard because one's just trying to do their job and trying to help, and the other one doesn't want to break his principle or his morals, and it's just a clash of heads.
Yeah, say you're in the AVL room,
yeah,
and your mate has just got absolutely whacked, and you get called in and you've got some solicitor who's changed from the last time that you've spoken to them telling you, look, listen, mate, prosecution case is the strongest I've ever seen that you should plead. You're thinking, I don't want to tell him myself. I haven't met this lawyer before. Do you think that in that circumstance, maybe what lawyers should be doing is going, okay, let's take a break, let's get to know each other a bit first?
100%, most definitely. Like, there's nothing worse than you meeting a solicitor for the first time and then telling you to plead guilty and that you're screwed. If you know nothing about them, I honestly believe that before all your matters or you go to the court, there should be like And I know it's hard because it's such a government funder, there's not enough money, but like, and time's that far stretched, but kind of a getting to know you period where like a solicitor can come in and go, oh, mate, well, this is me, this is a little bit about myself, I'm going to be representing you, I just want you to know this about me, and I'm going to try my best, or I'm going to do whatever I can to try to help you. But first, I think we should know a few things. Like, you just tell me a little bit about you so I know your background and how you ended up in this predicament that you're in. And then, so then you've got that kind of, not connection, because you can't connect with a stranger if you're an AVL suite, but kind of an understanding that, oh, hang on, maybe this bloke does actually want to help, or this lady does actually want to help, because she's taken the time to come see me, explain to me what's going on, see where I'm at and how I ended up in the place that, like, not me, but they're in. And it's kind of like, your walls kind of come down a little bit, because when you've got a stranger telling you to plead guilty and that you're screwed and you're going to lose so much time of your life, of course you're going to get defensive, especially if you've got other people or other inmates saying, nah, mate, you'll beat it. And 90% of the time, there's always some idiot that's going to sit there and tell you you're going to get found not guilty when they could have fingerprints on a murder weapon. So,
yeah.
But it would be good if there was enough, I suppose, like time or like people around to come in and meet with their clients before like court, like even if it's like a couple of weeks before court, or just to go, all right, I'm your solicitor, I'd like to get to know you and just find out a little bit about you, because by me knowing a bit about you, that can help me provide your defence. And then there's things you could pick up on that you're not going to pick up on when you go in there, when it's, you've got what, an hour before court to talk to your client, to go into a courtroom and then try to defend them. So there's lots of things that you're not going to pick up with their lives. So it would be, I think, not so much just to go like, here, we'll come back on another day, because then you feel like they don't want to help me, like they're just leaving, and then we're going to be getting closer again to court and I still haven't seen my solicitor. Like, that's a big issue, where I know plenty of solicitors, not personally, but from inmates have told me, and they've come back to the yard or the wing and been like, oh, I just went off my head at this solicitor, rah, 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 for the fact that they feel like that they haven't been putting in enough effort to see him, and it's getting closer and closer and closer to court, and you still haven't talked to anybody, and you don't have any clue that's going on, and all you've got is other inmates telling you their, what they think and their beliefs and how they think it's going to go, but they're not the ones that stand up in the courtroom trying to help you at the end of the day.
Yeah. Do you think, like, a good compromise, like, say you do have a lawyer, and yeah, we do have all these old legal organisations that are very underfunded, which is pretty sad, but just to know that your lawyer is working on your case, like getting a letter and things like that, or do you think the value is always in the voice, as in sitting down, phone calls, visits?
I believe, because letters, you could send a letter on, say, like the 1st of January 1999 and not get it to the 13th of February 1999.
Yeah.
For the fact that you've got no control on how corrective services issue them letters.
Mm.
So that's, as even though that your solicitor could be trying and could be sending you a letter once a week, you might not be getting them letters for once every month, for the fact that it's not like you can go to your letterbox and open it and go, oh, look, there's a letter from the solicitor. So I do believe that, like, phone calls, like AVL calls or AVL video calls, they're a lot better for the fact that you can see them, and then you kind of feel, well, hang on, he's actually here. Like, he showed up. He must, like, be putting in effort if he's coming and being in front of me, other than you getting a letter with a letterhead that's signed by a secretary and, like, not even your solicitor sometimes, and just says, oh, your matter will be dealt on such and such date at such and such courthouse. Such and such will be there to represent you.
Yeah.
So then, like, a lot of letters are very impersonal, if that makes sense. So it's more of a factor of just like, yeah, that's all you need to know, and that's it, more or less. Where with the phone calls and the AVLs, you're actually speaking to the person that you're going to see in that month or 6 months or whenever your court date is, and it's the familiarity that kind of helps, I think, too.
Yeah, I guess it gives you opportunity to build trust and connection, and also, like, a little bit more control over your matter in a way.
Well, I suppose with the letters too now, with corrective services and jails moving into a more technological period, like with tablets and stuff like that, if there was maybe some kind of connection where they could just email in person and they get it directly, and it saves the fact of it having to go through the mail room, then to wherever else it goes from the mail room to bring it to the wing, and then it sits in the wing for 3-4 days because the officers have had a fight and they've had to call a cert call. So a cert call is just an incident, if anyone doesn't know what a cert call is, sorry for that. But so there's been an incident and then they've had to deal with that, and then the mail will just sit there for another day or two. So that would maybe help if there was an individual channel just for solicitors and inmates to kind of speak on that channel, now that they got tablets inside of custody. But not every jail's got tablets yet either. So that's another hurdle.
Yeah.
No matter how much hurdles you clear, they're always going to put up another hurdle.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, speaking of hurdles, what do you think, what advice would you give to all new lawyers, maybe who haven't worked with Aboriginal people before, working with Aboriginal people in custody? What do you think things they need to keep in mind?
It's a good question. So not to label maybe is a big one. Like a lot of people now still like look at Aboriginal people, and for some reason a lot of people get a idea in their head and they think that a lot of Aboriginal people are the same and that they've got themselves in that trouble and they've made the silly decisions for the fact that they've been on drugs and alcohol since they were 12 years old. But not all of them have. And some just have precedents that happen in their lives, and they could be going to university or whatever and something happens and then they make a wrong decision and end up in jail. But because there's so many Indigenous people in custody, they're all looked at, well, most of corrective services population are Indigenous inmates.
Mm.
So it's the fact that, oh, well, it's just another Aboriginal bloke. He's obviously gone and done it. And a lot of them won't admit that, but it is that you do get that feeling too when it's like, oh, why? And then same as corrective services, like, I think the last 2, maybe 3 years I was in custody, there was NAIDOC days and you wouldn't even get a NAIDOC day for the fact that, oh, we're not giving it to you because we don't want to have to do the resources and the funds to deal with the NAIDOC day because, oh, there'll be a fight on NAIDOC day or you don't deserve NAIDOC day, but they'll give other cultures their days. So like Ramadan, for example, there's Ramadan every year.
Mm-hmm.
But NAIDOC, there's sometimes you get 2 sausages and a can of drink if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Same as like the fact that lawyers, they try their best, and I'm not saying they all label, but it is an unfortunate perspective that a lot of people have on Indigenous men that are in custody, is that they've obviously done it and they've been doing that since they were a kid and they're going to continue to keep doing it, which isn't always correct.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, being an Aboriginal lawyer myself, one thing that I really always forget that is really I guess unique to my family is what we were talking about earlier with the, you know, having those multiple generations and having those really important connections. And yeah. I think, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I think it's important to include your family in some matters but also not making that assumption. I mean, sometimes people don't want their family involved.
Yeah, that's another thing too. Like people think that people are Indigenous and they've always got family, where there's a lot of Indigenous people that aren't close to their mob or close to their family for certain factors or situations that's happened in their life through broken homes or domestic violence or sexual assaults as a child, and they've isolated from their family. But a lot of people think, oh, they're right, they've got family, you know what I mean? They've got someone to talk to, and a lot of time they don't. But it is a thing that's another stereotypical thing, because that many Indigenous people are so close to culture and family that they just expect that we all are.
Yeah.
So me personally, I think I had a lot of times in custody where I didn't speak to much family, but everybody always thought, well, but you've got family, you're right. But sometimes you don't. Like sometimes you're isolated from your family and there's certain reasons why your family can't come see you. Or they've got their own stuff going on and it's just as hard for them to come see you as it is as hard as you to not see them.
Yeah.
But is that still stereotypical? Oh, they'll be right.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that's the hardest part of being in custody is having family and maybe having different relationships with family and going through those waves of good relationships then bad relationships and kind of just being stuck in jail?
Yeah, no, I personally, the hardest things for me, and people are probably going to go, what do you mean, is visits. So visits is the hardest thing for me, or was the hardest thing for me in custody. And people are going to think, why are you saying that for? Like, your family's coming to see you. But there's nothing worse than watching your family turn your back on you and walk away, knowing that you're going to sit in a cell, a concrete slab by yourself without your family, knowing that they're not personally turning their back on you, but they're forced to leave you behind. So that was the hardest thing for me with visits, where it come to the end of my like sentence and halfway through my sentence and I just said, I don't want no more visits.
Yeah.
For the fact that I couldn't not deal with it, but it hurt too much to watch them walk away and watch them to leave, knowing that I couldn't be with them or I couldn't go home with them or I couldn't be with my children.
Yeah.
And the fact that when my kids went back to school and stuff like that, to them, they'd be like, their friends would be like, what'd you do on the weekend? And they'll be like, oh, I see my dad in jail. And all their friends are like, oh, well, we went here and we did this and we had this kind of fun. And I just didn't want it to be normal for the fact that my kids deserve so much better than that. And I shouldn't have been in that predicament to make them go through that in the first place. And them not being old enough or smart enough to understand and know why that they had to leave and I couldn't come home with them.
Yeah.
So me personally, that's the hardest part of custody is visits.
And so you said you stopped visits for a while. How long did you stop them for?
2 years, 2.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And was it hell? Like, you must have missed them.
Oh, I missed them like crazy every day. Like, there's not one time I can think of in the whole time I was in custody that I didn't think about my family. Mm. So, like, every day I think about my family and my children. But I couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't do it to them for the fact that they deserve so much better than what I could provide at that time in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And so what supports in custody did you have? Like, was it just the other inmates or to kind of get you through, well, particularly that 2 years, but I guess all of custody, all your whole 6 years, 9 months?
So do you mean like personal supports or like corrective supports or?
Well, whatever you genuinely think is supportive. I mean, we know that correctives run these programs, sure, but I guess it's more like what gave you some comfort, I guess? What kind of, was it other inmates kind of being there for you, or did you find support in other, perhaps more formal programs?
Well, see, I did a lot, most of my sentence in maximum security.
Yeah.
So even when I got my minimum security classification, I still had to do another 19 months in maximum security for the fact I had to complete a program, a violent offenders program, that was only housed in a maximum security wing. And that wing was housed with probably 70% of the inmates in there doing that program were minimum security, but it was the only place that they could do it. So programs wasn't really much of a thing that I actually had. I think I might have completed two programs that I had to complete, and like as of certificate of attainments, only two, because it's very rare for maximum security to have programs that you can be in and complete, because most maximum security jails, or not most, there is a lot that are sentenced now, but they're remand jails. And when you're on remand, you're not entitled to programs for the fact that you could go home tomorrow.
Yeah.
So there's not much you could do. And inmates support and inmates, yeah, it's a thing, but also a lot of inmates are for themselves. Like, you're always going to be number one, and the bloke standing next to you, yeah, he might be your friend and be there for you 1 minute, but when you're not there, he's going to stab you in the back. And unfortunately, that's just jail. And I'm not saying every person in jail is like that. Like, there is a lot of good blokes in jail, and I will admit that. But at the end of the day, you need to survive. And that's what you're there for, is to survive, to make it home. So you do make good friends, and there is good supports. But at the end of the day, everybody's main focus is supporting themselves and making it home, unless you're never to be released or you're going to got a sentence where you will end up dying in custody. So it's not that the inmates don't support you. It's the fact that that's always, I'm going to be nice, we're going to play cards or play squash or cut laps in the yard and be there for that. But that's only for 8 hours a day, if that, 6 hours. For the rest of the 18 hours a day, you're locked in a cell with another bloke that sometimes you might not know or you might not get along with. So me personally, my supports, I think, was the telephone and maybe the handful of like the dozen blokes that I actually do know that were genuinely there for me. So it's very hard to have supports if it's not like family or there's not programs. So me as an Indigenous inmate, we have things that are called SAPOs. So they're welfare workers. And by the end of my sentence, there was only two welfare workers for, I couldn't tell you the state of Indigenous inmates, but they had to go through three different areas of a correctional centre. And in each different area, there was probably maybe four or five wings, and each wing probably houses 40 blokes, 50 blokes. So you could imagine how many of them were Indigenous. And then if they were busy and you wanted to see a non-Indigenous welfare worker, the non-Indigenous welfare worker cannot see you for the fact that you're Indigenous and you've been provided an Indigenous welfare worker. So that's an issue too. So even them to be supports is hard. But there's like, corrective services do have a thing like a psychologist that you can put in a referral form, like a medical form, and ask to see like a psychologist if you want to, or talk to someone, or you can tell the welfare worker, and if they do get the time, they do get around to you, so they can be a support. But each person's got different supports. I could sit there and name five supports that supported me, and you could ask 10 other blokes and they might not name any of the same five that I named. So, but at the end of the day, I think it was telephone. Like, that was the number one support, was because it was, you just shut off and just be wherever you were talking on that phone and just try to picture that spot. And that really helped, I suppose.
Yeah. So we were talking earlier about your first experience of kind of being in a courtroom and watching everybody talk about you and feeling like you really had no control. I kind of want to dive back into that and talk about your experience generally of the criminal justice system. Do you think that there's anything that could change about either the justice or the jail system that's kind of relevant to Aboriginal people that would make them feel more empowered in their legal process?
There's definitely something that they do need to change, and a lot of people are going to probably complain about, but it is very controversial. And it's the fact of the treatment people get that have money compared to the people that get treated the way they do because they have no money. So you can have a person that can get charged for the exact same crime and have all the money in the world, and you can get a person changed for that same crime with no money in the world, and I guarantee you that at the end of the day, the person with money, no matter how identical the circumstances are and the facts are, they're going to always get a lenient sentence, and they're always going to get a better outcome for the fact that they're looked as privileged and an upstanding member of society, where if you come from nowhere and you are looked at of having a history and a cultural background of crime and drugs and poverty, they don't believe that you deserve a second chance, and they don't believe that you've got the willpower or the strength to change for the circumstances of your life. Where if you come from a background of money and support and having all the things that you need to succeed, for some reason they're looked at like they do get a second chance. And I just find, I don't understand how that can be a factor when it's the same crime, it's the same offence. You know what I mean? How does a person with money have a better opportunity to rehabilitate than a person without money? Like, it's some, that person could not have earned any of that money at all for themselves, and it could have been handed down from families that have earned it. Yeah, I'm not taking away the fact that they have had that money, but just because you've got money doesn't mean you have better opportunities to succeed and make something of yourself that somebody doesn't, because they come from poverty and haven't been fed with a silver spoon to say, like, I'm sorry, I'm not... I got people that I do know and like that have got money, so it's not like I'm having a dig at people that are rich, but it is just unfortunate the things that I have seen from my personal experience with the justice system, and seeing people in custody that have money to people in custody that come from nothing and got no support.
Totally. And I think like a good example of that that I can think of is when it comes to bail, is that people can put up these massive sureties of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. They've got mum who can put money down for us. And, you know, that mitigates your risk of failing to appear at court. And the reality is, for a lot of my clients, they don't have that privilege of having someone who's willing to cough up 10 grand on, you know, a supply prohibited drug, to make sure that they turn up to court.
That's exactly right. And it's just a shame for the fact that they ask for a shooter in a surety in so many matters, knowing that a person's not going to be able to come up with that kind of money because they have the history of their background and where they come from. And it's like, well, we're going to give you such false hope that you can get bail if you come up with this money, but we know that you're not going to be able to come up with the money, so you're still going to sit in custody on bail and your family can't come up with that money. So that's like, that is very disheartening. I've seen it that many times where someone's gone up for the exact same charge and they've been able to come up with their surety and they've gone home, where someone's been told by a family member that's only trying to do the right thing, yeah, we've got the money, yeah, we'll get the surety, and they get bail on a surety, but their family, something goes wrong and they can't provide that money and they're still stuck in custody.
Yeah.
Because that's a term of their bail condition. And it just goes back to, again, like I was saying before, like the privilege factor. And it's, if you've got money and you've earned that money, that's fine and you deserve to be where you are with that money, but it shouldn't be a stereotype that people with money have a better chance to succeed. And it's unfortunate that some things like that is just how the justice system is. It's, yeah, I could go into a lot more, but I don't want to offend certain people.
That's all good. And so, drawing on that, what do you think we could do? When I say we, I mean like criminal lawyers. What do you think that they, what would you need from your criminal lawyer in that circumstance? Or what do we need to change? Is it pushing for more changes in the law? Is it fighting harder for our clients?
That too, but also I think too of a surety, like a big thing is that you're in custody, you've got no one, you just want to go home. You hear the word surety, you're going to tell your lawyer you can get that money.
Yeah.
Your lawyer's going to go up sometimes because they are good lawyers and they believe the words coming out of your mouth and they're going to say, all right, we get that surety. But at the end of the day, they actually can't provide that money and they're given bail and it's just a false hope. And it's so disheartening. I could only imagine. I've never been in that predicament, thank goodness. But maybe with a surety, just to actually sit down and explain what's going to really happen if you cannot provide that money. Because I've been in court that many times and a solicitor's turned around to me and gone, I'll get you bail if you can put up $5,000-$10,000. And I haven't even asked. It's one of the first things that come out of their mouth because I'm like, will I get bail? And they're like, oh, have you got money? And I'm like, oh, how much money? And then they go, like, ridiculous amount of money. And it's like, why are you even suggesting that without checking first? It's just a false hope and you think, oh, I can go home. So certain people don't comprehend and aren't, not equipped, but not emotionally in the right place at the time to be thinking, oh, I'm going to get bail, but I'm not going to have the money and it's going to hurt even more. And it's going to hurt your mental state even worse. Well, in the end, I did nearly 2.5 years on remand. Like, I went for bail a couple of times at the start and I was over it by the end. I don't even think, like, I think I may have tried for Supreme Court bail, but I think I may have pulled it. Like, I'm not even sure if I did go through with it, but I know that many people that have come up with that many different changes of circumstances or that many different ways to keep going for bail. And honestly, I think they're the hardest words sometimes to hear when you're in custody or you're not even in custody, you've just been in the police cells overnight and you go to court for your mention, like your bail hearing, and they go bail refused. Like, just a daunting dark cloud that goes over your body and your mental state when you know that you're going to be playing a 4x4 for an undetermined period of time, and that is very hard on a lot of people's mental state. And it's so hard. Like, I've been across that many people that have been bail refused and that have unfortunately taken their lives because they can't deal with the fact that they don't know if they're going home or not. Or they've been sentenced to a sentence and they've been checked over by the nurse and the nurse has gone, yeah, they're fine. Next morning they're found hanging from their cell.
Wow.
So it is a very daunting thing to be bail refused or to be hit with a sentence. Some people just aren't mentally equipped for either they've been misled by their solicitor, misled by a fellow inmate, like, or just come up with assumptions and their own thoughts and ideas in their heads and hype themselves up so much that they've told themselves they're going to come home. Where I did the complete opposite personally. Like, I told myself I was going to get the worst sentence possible. So when I did get 8.5 years with a non-parole period of 6, I was very disappointed. Like, I'm not going to lie and say I wasn't disappointed, but that was for the fact that I was told and misled that I would have got a minimum of, like, I'm sorry, a maximum of maybe 4-5 years. And then to turn around and be sitting in the courtroom and then to hear the words, you were sentenced to a non-parole period of 8 years, 6 months. I mean, a jail sentence of 8 years, 6 months of a non-parole period of 6 years was just like, I sat there and told my solicitor the whole time, like, I'm not going to get that. I'm going to get worse. I'm going to get worse. And they kept saying, nah, mate, you'll be right. Like, there's no way in the world you'll get that. Like, believe me, you'll be right. I'm a solicitor. I know. Where in the end, I, not that I'm trying to brag about it, but it's not like I was that hurt and upset that I physically took my shoe off and was going to throw it at the judge. Like, I was that angry.
That might have made things a little bit worse for you.
Like, I'm glad that I snapped into it. And I think, I don't know if it was my mother, but somebody noticed that I took my shoe off because I had my leg crossed and they give me a look that was pretty much, I would have been pushing up daisies if it could have killed. But I did not make that decision. Always, always, I tell everyone that I've ever been in custody, you've always expect the worst, because then no matter what you get, you've already told yourself that's going to happen. So you're going to be even more comfortable and happier when you do get the good result, instead of vice versa, telling yourself you're going to get a good result, you're going home, and then you get a worse sentence possible.
Yeah.
Like, because some people can't, like, mentally be in that right state of mind to deal with that sometimes. And corrective services do the right thing and do a nurse check and try to make sure that you're right before they put you back in your cell and that. But there's that many people now, and a lot of people will understand, like, you can't notice depression and mental illness with certain people because they're really well at hiding it. And there's that many times where someone looks perfectly fine, they're the happiest person in the world, and next morning, unfortunately, they're gone. So you don't know what that person's going through. And for some solicitors, they're trying to do the right thing and encourage and be like, it's all right, mate. This will be the outcome. and I get they've got that experience with previous matters, but like I was saying before, not every like charge is sentenced the exact same way.
Yeah.
So you could know, all right, I've done five cases of, say, break and enter, and then five cases have got 2 years each, but then you get the sixth case and the poor guy gets 4.5 years, but you've told him he's only going to get two. Because at the end of the day, there's always different mitigating factors. There's always a different judge. There's always something that can go wrong. Mm. So it's just easier to not recommend a sentence, or not recommend a sentence, but not try to say, oh, this is what's going to happen. But I know it is hard because you just want to help your client and they're sitting there going, how long am I going to get, mate? How long am I going to get? What do you think is going to happen? Like, you're the solicitor, you tell me. But I just find it's worse. So, because that was just from my own personal experience. And I was just glad that I told everyone, like, that I was going to get a bad sentence. I just knew for some reason that I would have probably went off the rails. I don't think I would have, like, hurt myself, but I would have maybe hurt other people or went into a dark spot for the fact if I tried to tell myself everything was going to be fine and I was going home knowing I got a bad sentence after I misled all my family and myself and then that happened. Because you're not only letting yourself down once you get that information, you're on the phone or you're on a visit and you're going, my solicitor said this. It's all right, I'll be home. Or tell your kids, it's right, Dad will be home. But like I said, it's an uncontrollable factor no matter how many times a solicitor's done the exact same charge.
Yeah, definitely. So it's just about managing expectations, right?
Yeah, being 100%. Realistic. That's all it is. And I think if you make a worse expectation than a better one in that scenario, it's not relieving, but it's a little bit easier for the fact that you're already in a negative mind state. So if it is bad, it's like, oh, it's all right, I told myself that. Like, oh, that's not good, like, but it's like, oh, at least I was prepared for that. You know, it's a little bit of relief and a little bit of weight is the fact instead of getting hit by a bag of bricks.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And talking about, you know, when things, I guess, go wrong, what do you think is important for your lawyer to do when they make a mistake? Like, would you want to know that your lawyer's made a mistake? Would you want an apology? Would you just want them to be transparent, not bullshit?
Oh, definitely transparent. I've got to admit, like, when I got sentenced, in the end, I had my lawyer that tried for me through trial till I changed my plea, like, through trial, was really good. Like, I wanted him to represent me with the CCA, and he was the most honest lawyer I've ever had. Like, he come down and goes, I'm so sorry, mate. And I said, what are you sorry for? He goes, I feel like it's my fault. And I said, what do you mean? I said, you did everything possible that you could do. I said, I want you to help me and do my appeal. And he goes, no, nah, I don't want to. And I got offended. I felt really like, I thought, oh, what have I done? And then he continued to talk, and he's like, nah, because if I've made a mistake and I've done something wrong, he's like, you shouldn't have got that sentence, like I was saying earlier. But he's like, I don't want to be the reason why your appeal gets knocked back. He goes, because if I did make that mistake, I want somebody else to be able to pick up on it, to realise that that was the mistake, where if I go all over it again, I might miss the same mistake. So I haven't had many lawyers like that, but the transparency of him and the honesty to say, like, that could have been my fault, was not really relieving, but was real kind of like understanding and like vulnerability for the fact that, oh, he's actually human. Like, he's admitting and taking responsibility to make sure that he cares about the outcome of another human being, an individual's life. And if a lot of solicitors could turn around and be like, all right, well, this happened and I believe that that was my mistake and I'm just going to sit here and tell you now, I know you're probably not going to be happy, I'm going to get caught every name under the sun, or no matter what the inmate's reaction is, at the end of the day, that person hopefully will go back to their cell, excuse me, or back to wherever they're going and be like, all right, yeah, they stuffed up, they made a mistake, but he owned it. So yes, I believe transparency would be a really good thing, but even if you're not in the criminal system, even if you're not a defence lawyer, even if you're a prosecutor, sometimes they make mistakes. And I guarantee you, they're not going to say, oh, I made a mistake. Because you could be working at Kmart, for example, and break something. You're not going to want to own up to it.
Yeah.
It's the exact same as when you're in custody or you're in like a criminal matter.
Yeah.
Nobody, no matter what kind of side of law you're at or whatever you do personally in your life, people very rarely like to admit, I f***ed up. And it's just the nature of a human being. You don't want to tell yourself that you did something wrong because you're in denial.
Yeah.
So I understand how it can be hard to go, oh, that was my fault. You know what I mean? But I believe if you can do that, you're a lot better with yourself mentally and emotionally and adapt with other people and surroundings. It's good to have that kind of perspective and empathy to realise that that is a position that you've got to be able to relate to no matter what the circumstance is.
Yeah. definitely. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the criminal code kind of not wanting to tell on yourself. And that's why you don't want to plead guilty to charges, even when it is a strong prosecution case.
Yeah. Well, does it, like, you get to the stage where I think when you're young and you start entering into crime, and obviously when you start entering into crime, you always look up to the kids or the adults or the people that are above you and doing the bigger things.
Mm.
And they're always the first thing is don't tell. You know what I mean? Like, and then after it's don't tell or don't give up your friends or keep your mouth shut, it's like if you ever get caught, not guilty. And it's like, what do you mean? Why? But if I can get a lesser sentence and I can get a discount, why? And they go, nah. Because if you can tell on yourself, you can tell on someone else.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, if you're willing to give yourself up and yourself is the person that matters the most to you, well, you're not going to hesitate to give somebody else up.
Yeah.
And that's how it's. Look, it's the same as in custody. If you got drugs in your system and you go to a urine test, you get told not to urine. Because if you urine and then your urine test comes back positive, you've technically given up the boys in the yard. So therefore, you haven't told on the individual that's got the illegal drugs, but you've more or less told the officers that there's drugs in that yard.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Like, it's just, I mean, you get yourself into trouble before you admit that guilt.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so, but I don't think solicitors would look at it like that. Well, I hope they don't anyway. So,
yeah,
they're going to go home and their boss or their supervisor is going to smack them on the head.
No, but I think it's good. I think it's good to be open and honest and remember that you are human and you're allowed to make mistakes. So we were talking about how you were when you were younger and you're kind of looking at the bigger boys or the older adults and they're doing the bigger crimes and you're looking up to them. Do you think at that stage, if we can call it, for want of a better word, your criminal career, that was when you needed the most support? Like, what would have kept you out of custody, do you think?
That's a very hard question to blame on one sector of, well, I'll say the government, like, because I was in a, like, juvenile justice or counsellors or youth workers or behavioural schools or education department, so...
Mm.
It's too hard to sit there and just pinpoint one sector and pick on one sector.
Yeah.
But, like, personally, so, like, social workers and youth workers, for one, were a big thing where I could not relate to them for the simple fact that they were textbook. So when I was growing up, there was no one that actually had been through, I found, relevant life experience or any circumstance that could even remotely, like, match or understand that what I was going through. But they'd all sit there and try to tell you how much they understood and how much they could relate to you. But at the end of the day, they're going to paragraph 4A, page 2, line 3.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, mate, that's a book. Like, you're not understanding. I'm witnessing this with my two eyes. Like, I've lived this my whole entire life. And you're telling me somebody that's writ a book that's got a PhD because they've studied can actually understand what I'm going through. So that made me rebel and push away. The fact that I had a criminal parent that had been in the judicial system, that was a drug addict, that didn't help either.
Yeah.
You know, like, so always seeing that negative side of life, like violence in school and then doing things that pushed me away from my own family, where my own family tried to help that much that I kept shitting on them and they were like, we give up. Like, you're not listening, we're trying to help and you just keep like spitting in our faces. Like leaving school when I should have turned around and just pulled me head in for the fact that I'd get bored with schoolwork or I'd get in trouble for a fight and get suspended and then come back and not understand the work we were doing and then get frustrated and carry on and get suspended again.
Mm.
You know, so like there's so many different things that where I had certain things going on in my life where if people could have noticed and maybe paid a bit more attention, yeah. But then there's also times where I look back and think, well, some people did notice and pay attention and I didn't want their help because I couldn't relate to them either.
Yeah.
So is it their fault I couldn't relate to them even though they tried to help?
Mm.
But I think more people, hopefully, that can get into certain avenues of like social work and community services and like that, that have had life experience with the people and the clients they're trying to work with. Like, I understand not so much maybe legal matters for the fact that you can't really have a criminal record or be like that to represent clients, yeah, but like,
yeah,
social workers that have had like a homeless upbringing or had to have parents that are like addicts or mental health or have got in like a little bit of trouble when they were juvenile to be able to help, you know what I mean? Like, people that actually can sit there and go, well, this is understandable, mate. Like, I could say I can relate to you, but I'm only reading from a book, where someone that can actually go, yeah, like, I can't tell you exactly all about my life, because in certain areas of that work, you can't really disclose anything of your personal life to a client, which is understandable. But to have the answers where the person that you're talking to is going to actually be like, hang on, did he just say that? Like, how does he know that? And then by you realizing that he knows that, you think to yourself, oh, maybe he's been through some stuff. And then you kind of, your walls come down a little bit, where it's not like legal jargon from a book that's going, paragraph A, page 2, line 4, says that you're only doing this because of some diagnosis that some scientist has come up with 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So that would have helped a lot, I think, like counsellors and youth workers and stuff like that. Like,
and maybe lawyers. Maybe that's what's wrong with the system, you know?
Honestly, they say that criminals are the best lawyers, so.
Well, I've been very impressed by your knowledge since you've been out of custody. And I think, you know, you would make a great lawyer.
Yeah, so, but it's like counsellors. Like, everybody says to someone that if you give good advice, you should be a counsellor, which is ridiculous because nobody knows. The first thing you learn in your counselling course is you cannot give advice. So everyone that's ever been told that they should be a counsellor because they give good advice is getting misled.
Yeah.
Because you can't do it. It's illegal.
Yeah. So one big question, we're kind of getting towards the end of things. So I really want to ask you, because the government has put together this funding under the National Closing the Gap Agreement, and some of the things that they're focusing on are the overrepresentation of Aboriginal men and women in custody and young people in custody. What support do you think that either legal firms or correctional centres or the government generally could put in place that would have helped divert you from and help change that statistic, that there are so many Aboriginal people in custody?
That's back the same thing again, is more Indigenous workers and programs and trying to get kids from school to understand, to go into that factor of social work and youth work and teaching and lawyers, for the fact that you understand the aspect and the background of your culture more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Anybody can read up, like I was saying before, about culture and knowledge, but to actually have cultural diversity to cultural upbringing.
Yeah, that lived experience.
Yeah, it's completely different. So I think just trying to poach, maybe would be the word, or just collect and give information to more Indigenous kids, and the fact of the effect and the help they could provide if they got into them sectors, because there's not many of us that are in them sectors to actually help. And if you look at like juvenile justice and stuff like that at the moment, like a lot of the kids and stuff that are getting in trouble come from multicultural backgrounds. And it's a very ethnic diverse area. And if you look at them sectors with them children getting into trouble in them areas, you wouldn't, like, I think maybe there'd only be a handful in each sector of their own ethnicity working in them sectors to help them personally and understand their cultural background. Where, so just the fact of having more people from their culture, especially Indigenous people as social workers and youth workers and welfare workers in custody, teachers, stuff like that, just to help understand and relate would be a big factor and be able to lead kids down the right path.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of leading people down the right path, what's in the future for you?
At the moment, I'm trying to enter that sector myself, but with such a criminal history that I do have, it is going to be hard to enter that sector, for the fact that I do have an extensive criminal record, and that's not going to be in my best interest. But so far it's been going pretty good. So I'm not entering community services, but I am entering youth work, for the fact that I never had, like I was saying, a youth worker that I could relate to. And I don't want to mentor or try to tell some kid what to do, but I want to be able to sit there and understand a kid and know what he's going through, so hopefully he can look and go, okay, well, he has been through some things and he genuinely does care, and then he might go home and think about things in a different perspective and decide to go his own way instead of making the same mistakes he's making. Where everybody goes, oh, so you want to mentor kids? No, I don't want to mentor. Like, if I can mentor, I'll happily mentor, but it's more about helping kids understand and realise and make their own decisions and understand that what they're doing is going to lead them down a path that they can't return from. And that's the thing I wish I had the most when I was younger, not the fact that people telling me this is what you're going to do, this is where you're going to end up, and this is what you've got to do, but being able to make me understand and realise for myself and make my own decisions to understand that this is the outcome, this is the factor, and it's not good.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing that's probably up for me in the future. But if that doesn't happen, I'll have to find something else that I'm interested about and got enough emotion into to move forward. But definitely custody is not in my future in any time soon. So
excellent news. And so do you think that for working with maybe young people going through the juvie system or young adults, maybe having a youth worker or a social worker who is Aboriginal alongside their lawyer would perhaps help that communication barrier?
Definitely. With juveniles, 100%. Like, just to have an Indigenous worker there for them would mean so much. To have, yeah, like a social worker or a youth worker just to help and be able to culturally relate and understand things that their solicitor might not be able to pick up to go, all right, well, this is the way he's acting, the way he's saying, oh, this word you've used triggered him, because they don't realise that. They're just trying to do what they think is best for the client, but sometimes they could be offending and missing culturally diverse things that are offensive.
Yeah.
And making the kid go, well, you don't understand my background, you don't understand my history, you don't understand my culture, I don't want to work with you. Like, And these days I know a lot of people that are younger than me really believe it's a really terrible racist world, unfortunately, and they feel like they're set up to fail and that everybody's only out to screw them over. So to have someone that is of their culture or their background to be like, we're here to actually help, I think would make a big difference. But like I said before, it's so hard without going to schools and stuff like that to get them kids into that position to be that adult for the next generation.
Yeah.
Because I'm almost 30 and we still haven't got nowhere near as many people in them sectors as I would have liked to see from when I was that age to now. So hopefully there's the kids that are a generation below me and a generation below that that realise that our culture is not going to be helped or not be able to change unless they actually put their foot down and do something personally about it, is going to be a hard, unfortunately, a very hard way for us to get the perspective and the stereotype change for us, because they think, well, if it means that much to you, why aren't you helping each other?
Well, thank you so much for meeting with me today and having a good old yarn to me about all these things. I think it's really given us a really great perspective. There's just nothing out there from the experience of somebody like you who's actually been through the system. But before you go, I just wanted to ask whether you had a message for anyone going through court, serving time, or even their lawyers. Any parting notes?
Eventually you will walk out them gates, and hopefully after you've done whatever you've done and the time you've served to pay back for the crimes you have committed, that you do realise that you do have a second chance and that the rest of your life is in your hands. So you always control your path and you always control the outcomes of the decisions you make. So never think that you're not good enough to succeed or that you don't deserve a second chance, because everybody deserves a second chance and everybody can change. Just to be out, just to see grass, see the moon of a night, see the sunrise, sunset, just the little things that actually do we miss in there more than anything.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me.
No worries. This is never going to happen again.
Absolutely. And thank you. You've been listening to Legal Aid, New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast.
So how much do I get paid for this?